Thanks, Oliver. I'm going to call Davis Baird to the stand right now, speaking of lobsters. Davis Baird's once the Department of the Philosophy, now USC Nano Center, and Dean of the Honors College, a very busy man. But a few years ago, he was kind enough to invite me over to his house, and we looked at some exquisite Kodachrome movies that his father, a scientific instrument maker, shot during his childhood in Maine. So I'm not sure if you've got a chance to meet the film archivist from Maine here, but they'll be interested in talking to you further. So to talk about nanotechnology and the unfilmable world, which nevertheless needs to be represented in moving images now, please welcome Davis Baird.
Thank you. Let me see here. I need to find mine. No films of Maine here, I'm afraid. I got interested in films, or moving images, I should say, of the nanoscale because I have been, for various purposes and with various audiences, trying to explain nanotechnology. Typically, I start with something about where does the word come from, nanotechnology, and I thought it might be useful in this audience to start there as well. On the right, this is a set of prefixes that was set by an international commission. That's why we have kilometers and micrometers, and indeed why we have nanotechnology, nano being the prefix for 10 to the minus ninth, or 1 billionth. 1 billionth of a meter, and it's an interesting scale for a whole variety of reasons. Perhaps some of it came through with the Powers of 10 film we saw. At the nanoscale, this is really the scale which atoms and molecules combine to form the material basis of the world around us. So the stable materials happen at the nanoscale. Nanotechnology is interesting for a whole slew of reasons. I'll mention three quickly. One is that when you start gaining control of things at the nanoscale, you can exploit new properties of these things. These properties are the features of quantum mechanics, and I won't go into the details there, but there's really quite a lot that can be done with these new properties. Another feature about the nanoscale, which is interesting and worth pondering, is surface area. If you imagine taking a ball and shrinking it and shrinking it and shrinking it, the amount of volume to the surface decreases. And for most chemistry, what happens on the surface is what's vitally important. So chemical catalysts, which help reactions happen, do their work on the surface. And nanoscale materials have lots and lots of surface relative to the amount of stuff you have, so they can be more efficient. And finally, for reasons that I will try to explain in a second, there is a lot of space at the nanoscale. That can sound kind of contradictory or weird. So, in fact, these are the same images you saw. I'm not going as far as the Eames powers of 10. I'm merely going down to the nanoscale. That would be 10 to the minus ninth. And I have explained this in numerous audiences, and I have to say my impression is you can go, you know, a meter, a tenth of a meter, a hundredth of a meter, maybe a thousandth of a meter, and after that it gets pretty abstract. I don't know if that was your perception. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the film we saw earlier. Yes, you can keep going down by powers of 10, but who really knows what it means to go from 10 to the minus fifth to 10 to the minus sixth and then on to the nanoscale. On the other side of it, of course, you can go from a meter to the gigameter. And as I was sitting here earlier, I reflected on the fact that I brought a flash drive, which is a 4 gigabyte flash drive, which would mean it's 10 to the ninth bytes. Indeed. But I think there is one very, for me, useful way to explain how big the nanoscale is. If you look at a gigameter, that would be 10 to the ninth meters, roughly something a little bit bigger than the orbit of the moon. So if you imagine we want to arrange a meter's worth of nanoscale-sized objects, one way of thinking about what that is doing is arranging an orbit of the moon's sized meter-size objects. And if you start to think about taking things that are roughly a meter in size and ordering them in a space that's the size, a surface area the size of the orbit of the moon, I think that does carry home the point that really there is a lot of space at the nanoscale. That's why you can put so much information on a 4-gigabyte flash drive. I got quite interested in images of the nanoscale because I'm also trying to convey what the nanoscale is like. What that might mean, I'm not quite sure. These are two images, very famous image of 35 xenon atoms manipulated by a microscopist, Don Eigler, in 1989 to spell out the initials of his employer, IBM. It's a remarkable tour de force of imaging, but also of manipulation. He actually put these atoms there where he wanted them. They look rather tidy. I like that. They look to me rather like blue Hershey's Kisses on a table. Of course, they're blue. As compared with that, this is a transmission electron micrograph of two gold atoms that the German artist Gerhard Richter appropriated and created a piece of art called My First View of an Atom. I like Richter's image because, in fact, it is blurry. It doesn't look nice and tidy. And the problem with Eigler's presentation is it's decontextualized. We've heard that word. This is an image, Eigler's image, was made at ultra-high vacuum. There was virtually nothing else there at almost absolute zero. Had there been any temperature there, these atoms would not have stayed still long enough. But that's lost. So you just see this image and you think, oh, yeah, we can move atoms around at will. It's rather like moving Hershey's Kisses around at will on the tabletop. And this is an important kind of misperception that prompts a lot of people to make, and I, in my view, potentially misperceived views about what we might be able to do with nanotechnology. That's what got me interested in moving images of the nanoscale, because I thought they might capture a bit more of the dynamism of the nanoscale. And so we have, by contrast with Eigler's image, this is a simulation of a small bit of DNA interacting with water molecules. And it's actually very slow motion. And what I think is what comes out most powerfully from this is that a lot of motion is happening there. The DNA is not just sitting there as a static double helical ladder, but it is moving quite a lot as it interacts with water. And I thought, well, so maybe if we had more moving images of the nanoscale, we'd get a better picture of the dynamism of the nanoscale. And that started me on a hunt. And so what I have really for the rest of my presentation is, you might say, a kind of cabinet of curiosities. It's just a whole series of moving images of the nanoscale. They're ordered in a way which I think should be kind of obvious as I move along. This image is real data. So this is captured with a scanning tunneling microscope of oxygen mediation diffusion of oxygen vacancies on the top of titanium dioxide. So you're seeing 250 frames taken over, I think, 9 seconds of these interaction with oxygen molecules and titanium and a titanium dioxide surface. The other image, I won't explain. It's actually there because about 3 weeks ago, some researchers at Georgia Institute of Technology developed a new scanning head, a new way to actually get these images, which would produce, I guess, 100 times faster images. So this is pretty slow. It took, you know, you have 250 images over 10 seconds. Maybe if you had more images, you get more resolution. Now, this is also real data, but it's a single piece of data that's then been treated to digital magic, so it looks like you're flying through it on a helicopter. And one of the things about this that I think is also rather pertinent to think about, it looks like you're flying through a landscape of roughly mountainous kinds of things. These are atoms. And we were I was presenting images like this at another venue, and somebody in the audience said, I always thought atoms were spherical. How come they're always conical in these scanning tunneling microscope images? Excellent question. And the reason they're conical is because the way we're capturing the data is with a conical shaped structure, the scanning head, which comes down. You could imagine, think of that as an atom. You have this conical shaped head coming down, and it's going to bump up, over, and down. So the shapes you're seeing here are actually it's the reflected shape of your instrument, not the shape of the atom. Although that's also decontextualized in these images. Of course, we have IBM. I presented a version of this talk about 2 weeks ago at Penn State, and they said, well, we have to give you our own helicopter flyby, which they did, and here it is. You're seeing the Penn State helicopter flyby, and of course, you don't have IBM. You have Penn State. This is perhaps worth pausing on for just half a second. One of the things that is very striking, as scientists began to gain control manipulating materials at this scale, one of the things they did was they started carving their initials. And it is really pretty remarkable. And there are many, many examples of this. Now, this is not what I would call real data. This is a simulation of a piece of DNA, again, interacting in an aqueous environment. And so you can think of it as a kind of schematic representation. But as opposed to the schematic representation on the right, this schematic representation is trying to show you motion, not just structure. Of course, it's also interesting to think about the fact that at this scale, so a DNA molecule roughly across the DNA molecule, that's about 2.3 nanometers. This is much, much shorter than the wavelength of light. So, in fact, these materials have no genuine color of their own. The color is added, and they have no shadow like this. So all of this is added to give you the impression of something that's sort of like an ordinary-sized object. Perhaps the first and most important nanomaterial was the Buckminster fullerene. This was discovered in 1986 or 7, I think, by Harry Croteau and Richard Smalley, who died about 2 weeks ago. Buckminster fullerene is a form of carbon. You have 60 carbon atoms that bond together into, the way it's always presented, is a perfect geodesic-like dome structure. I particularly like this simulation of the formation of Buckminster fullerenes because, in fact, it's not such a perfect spherical dome-like structure. It's rather an irregular structure, and the manner of its formation is rather more higgledy-piggledy. So you get the impression, in fact, that chemistry is not such an orderly science. By contrast, perhaps, once you have Buckminster fullerenes, you can make these other materials called carbon nanotubes, which is where you imagine taking the round thing and sort of extending it out into a tube. And here we have two such tubes with these little additional teeth, molecular teeth on them, being created into a gear simulation. There was a lot of interest in the late 90s and early 2000s in making genuine motors with gears and armatures and all of that stuff out of materials like this. And so they started trying to simulate these things. I actually think that these motors are never going to be built, not because they wouldn't be useful or anything, but because really they don't exploit the scale. And the reason we're thinking about them is because we're thinking of Hershey's Kisses on a table instead of thinking about an extremely vigorous, active world of thermal motion where we could use different properties to get motors. But nonetheless, another interesting simulation. This is a carbon nanotube under compression. So we're imagining we're going to use this as a beam in some kind of a structure, and we're going to press it and see what happens to it. Again, of course, the color is all conventional color, although it's not quite conventional. Red is chosen, I think, to represent broken bonds between the carbon atoms, and red is the right color for a broken bond, I suppose. Note down at the bottom, by the way, the 57.45 PS, that's picoseconds. Another feature to be aware of, these are extremely slow motion images. So a picosecond, that's 10 times shorter than a nanosecond, so it's 10 billionths of a second. Then I started finding movies that are clearly aimed at more straight-up pedagogical purposes. So this one on the left, again, note the probably hard to see the picoseconds over in the far left. That's water in a beaker, or in a space roughly 3 nanometers by 3 nanometers by 3 nanometers. And then this is to show you the structure of a fairly complex protein that forms this nice little ball-like structure with a bunch of subcompounds. Here again, these are cartoons, but they're aimed to tell you something about either the dynamism of the nanoscale, that's the water case, or the structure of the nanoscale, that's the protein. Another cartoon, this is a little longer. It's the growth of a flagellum. I'll let you watch it. I rather like the nice use of shadow and light, all artificial, of course. Don't know what the little white dots that appeared there and then disappeared are all about. Off into space. One of my biologist colleagues here really liked this movie. I think he really enjoyed how it showed how a flagellum grew. What I actually like about it the most is how it uses, as it were, camera angle and motion, so to say, to show dimension. Because these things are very long and very small, so this way you get a sense of their dimensions. I'll let this one speak for itself.
The branching networks in biological dendritic neural trees provide signal switching and processing operations at the locations of the branching. A similar concept, therefore, can be proposed to fabricate branching networks similar to dendritic neurons, but made of single or multi-wall branched carbon nanotube networks. For example, here we show a model of a four-level dendritic neural tree that has been made of 14 carbon nanotube Y-junctions, or networks with single branching. The Y-junctions at each level of branching are shown in a single color. For example, the contribution of a single Y-junction to a complex branching network is indicated by the blue highlighted structure is shown here. Recently, such single Y-junctions have been fabricated in experiments at various laboratories within the United States and abroad. Our quantum conductance simulations have shown that they have robust ballistic switching and rectification behavior. In the future, artificial nanoscale dendritic trees made of carbon nanotubes could be grown in experiments that would serve as biomimetic models of new computing architecture based on dendritic neurons in a biological system.
This really is not pedagogy. It's not really much of a simulation either. It's not taken from any genuine data. The choice of the soundtrack and the voiceover, I found this really rather astounding, this particular movie, clearly meant to market Srivastava's research, and I gather that what he's been able to do is make a lot of Y-junction carbon nanotubes, but actually making dendritic carbon nanotube Y-junction trees, that's yet for the future. Now, the next two movies are related to each other. This is just a short loop, which is genuine data of a nanostructure. Exactly what it is, a little unclear from this movie, but you got this blob in the middle that's going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it's called a rotational actuator, and you'll see in a minute why it might be called that. But what I particularly like is the comparison between, this is the actual data that the scientists have, and the next movie shows you their conception of what this data is representing. That's a carbon nanotube, given by God, I think. This is a layer of gold, also given by God. We're going to melt away a bunch of the gold and a bunch of the substrate. I don't know what that is. And you have this little blob of gold in the middle of on a carbon nanotube with these four doohickeys. Now, what is actually rather striking here is this. So you see how a carbon nanotube looks like sort of chicken wire, and each of the little central blobs is an atom of carbon. So you have the nanotube represented as individuated atoms. So it's a multi-walled tube. This is important for the function here. But note the gold is not represented as atoms. Gold is a continuous material. So you're breaking some of the bonds on the outer carbon nanotube so that it can then spin on the inner carbon nanotube as an axle. And it spins in response to electric fields provided by the four gold electrodes. I mean, there is a question of whether it really does look like that, given the data, but still pretty interesting. Well, yes, of course. Think about yourself for a moment. All biology is nanotechnology. We are all created, roughly speaking, atom by atom, molecule by molecule. So one of the arguments that we should be able to make really pretty impressive things out of nanotechnological techniques is nature can do it with life. So we should be able to do at least that well. So that's really what I have for you, just a kind of cornucopia of different kinds of movies, documentation from specific specimens, so the STM movies, or the flybys from actual data that they took. Also, simulations of various sorts. I actually particularly like Vixek's simulation of a DNA strand in water. But also the carbon, the C60 synthesis, the gears and the beams. And then a variety of cartoons, water, the motion of water with temperature, the creation of a protein structure, the growth of a flagellum. And finally, these marketing movies clearly meant, I believe what these were created for was to take to NSF, to say, look, we are doing some very cool research. You want to give us more money so we can do more research and we can make these dendritic carbon nanotube trees. Anyway, with that, thank you very much for listening.